You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
The new book by Josie Islin and Ellen Littweiler is The Mysterious World of the Bull Kelp Forest. Thank you for joining me, ladies.
Absolutely delighted.
The measure of how good a book is, and is in many ways how memorable it is. For me, I like to read books, and when I think back on reading a book, it's almost like I'm taking a vacation in wherever the book takes place. And with a nonfiction book, what can happen is it can transform your vision of the world. For the past 20 years, I have been walking up and down the Aptos Beach with my dogs every morning. And on my right is the land, and I can look up and see, you know, the mountains with their trackless forests and really beautiful, and think how life-affirming, how much variety of life is up in those forests. And on my left would be the ocean. And I know it's large, but, you know, it's just waves. That's all I can see. So I never thought much about it. After reading your book, when I walk up the coast now, I realize that I'm between two forests. The small one is the one on my right. That's the land-based forest in the mountains. The large one is the one that's on my left. And it is filled quite close to me with a forest of bull kelp. Amazing job changing my vision. Let's start with the website. This book was based on a website. Josie, what made you decide to create a website dedicated to kelp and in a specific variety of kelp, which I didn't know existed, bull kelp?
Rick, I have to say your description of your walk on the beach is just so wonderful, because I too am a beach walker. I've been walking the same beach for 35 years. Ellen too has, you know, grown up on Mir Beach. For me, it's Fort Funston in San Francisco. And I'm so conscious that the ocean creates a lid on its surface that we're hoping to crack open a little bit, and that you now have these two forests in mind as you walk the beach is just, it makes our heart so warm. Ellen is nodding away here. That's really, we feel like the book is really hitting home in the way that we wish. I've been thinking about kelp and seaweed for a long time as an artist. I'm a photographer by training, and I started putting seaweeds and kelps on my flatbed scanner about 20 years ago almost. And then started learning about the science of the seaweeds and kelps because I was so curious about what I was looking at in my studio. And I wrote a book called The Curious World of Seaweed. And the second chapter was the bull kelp chapter. So that book has 16 chapters, each on an iconic kelp or seaweed that you would find on the beach as you were walking along. They're all here in California. But as I was writing that second chapter on bull kelp, the canopy forming kind of foundational kelp of our Northern California coasts, it was in rapid decline. There were all sorts of stressors really impacting these bull kelp forests that the divers out there could see was changing rapidly. And so I felt like its particular story was really important to get out there in a holistic sense, so that all of us would know that there were fires going on under the ocean, just like they were going on land, that there was all this change happening, but that few could see. So the fact is that I was having a hard time getting my publisher to say yes to the book. I had the structure all figured out, that it would include all these characters that make up the drama of the kelp forest, and that it would go across its range so that we could see what was happening in the different regions that bull kelp is, because it's quite different what's happening in different areas. But books take a really long time. And I met this wonderful designer, Marianne Leuschel, who, when we just got together, we kind of looked at each other and said, let's make a website. And as soon as we decided to say to make a website, we knew we needed a homepage illustration that really knocked your socks off. And I had worked with Ellen on a number of other projects before. And so we immediately called up Ellen and said, Ellen, would you be the illustrator for us for this website? And so it's been this wonderful collaboration and design journey and storytelling journey. And the website has proved to be very, very successful. We've had 43,000 users on that deep dive website. And then Heyday said, yes, let's make a book. And that's been super, super fun. Again, working with Ellen to refine the imagery and do the layout and kind of take that same structure that we had for the website, where we're telling the story of all the characters that make up this rich, biodiverse forest under the ocean, and take it into the book format.
That's one of the things I think that worked very well is creating a story. And I love Ellen's illustrations. They're so beautiful. They're open. So, as much as I love underwater photography and all the amazing things you can see because of it, the painting format here is really nice because it opens up the space and it really works extremely well with the design of the book. The book is reads like lightning. And that's due to both the great writing and the great design. And I just realized now that also you identified that there is a story to tell, a narrative, and that takes us through the book. I have been walking, as I mentioned, on the beach for 20 years. Have seen many kelp slabs washed up ashore. It never occurred to me that there were different species of kelp. So, talk about the exact, first off, tell us exactly what kelp is. I look at it and I say, well, it's got stalks, it's got leaves, it's a plant. That's about as far as I got. And sometimes it looks like a monster from outer space with a lot of tentacles. Probably not that. So tell us exactly what kelp is and talk about the varieties of kelp, which I never knew existed. I thought kelp was kelp.
Well, Ellen, you can talk as well as I, but so kelp is a subset of the seaweeds, and the seaweeds come in three categories. There's red, there's green, and there's brown seaweeds. And the kelp are in the brown category, and kelp tend to be the big, bulkiest seaweeds that are out there. They grow a little bit deeper often. So bull kelp itself grows out in deeper water. The kelps tend to be more differentiated, like they have parts to them. And algae or kelp, which is a marine algae, they're not plants. They have some things about them that are really different than our plants on land. Number one is how they're attached to the bottom. So all of these kelps and seaweeds have a holdfast, and that holdfast's only role is to attach it to a rocky substrate, a rocky bottom. They grow very fast because they are photosynthesizers. So they're using the energy of sunlight and the nutrients of the oceans to create biomass very quickly. And so for the bull kelp, they are growing as a singular stipe, which is the term used for a stem. It's very long and thin when it first begins to grow. And then over the course of only a few months, because this kelp is an annual species, the bull kelp, it can grow up to 60 feet tall. So if it's in 60 feet of water, it develops a gas-filled bladder called a pneumatocyst. And that function is to pull this organism up towards the surface. So the blades, those, they're not leaves, they're called blades, which have the surface area to photosynthesize as efficiently as possible. Those want to be up as close to the sunshine as possible. So the gas-filled bladder is pulling this organism up towards the surface. And once it gets to the surface, at that time, it can be a really large, mature bull kelp. It's created, 30 pounds of biomass in just a few months, which is extraordinary. And it kind of lays itself out on the surface, which is what you might see at low tide. And the blades kind of hang down, and those are what are drawing in the sunlight and going through the remarkable process of photosynthesis.
And those tangled masses of the bull kelp are what you see washed ashore. That could be those sea creatures with all the tentacles that you're talking about. They kind of become, if you see them from afar, sometimes they look like a washed ashore creature because they're massive tangles of those of the stipes and the blades. But that's the bull kelp that comes up. At least up in this area. I'm not sure about down in there.
You might have some of the giant kelp as well, because there are two big kind of foundational canopy-forming kelps in California. The one that's most dominant in Southern California is giant kelp, and we have that as one of our characters. And then bull kelp is really dominant in Northern California and up into the Pacific Northwest. And they mingle around Monterey, Santa Cruz. Down into Central California, they kind of come together. So those are the two big kelps.
You know, Ellen, one of the things I got from the paintings you did was that up till now I would always thought of the ocean as super crowded and kind of murky, and every place near the bottom was filled with kind of junk or, seaweed or whatever. And I think your illustrations create a landscape more like the savanna of Africa, was sparsely populated. It's really quite beautiful. Talk about, are you a photographer? Do you dive in and have you actually seen these things, or do you just paint them from your mind?
So I have not dived. I do swim in the ocean a lot, but I do not do any diving. I was just answering some questions actually for somebody else about how illustration works in understanding what you're doing. And I think part of this whole project, like working on the website and working on the book, is that with illustration, there's a process of observing something and thinking about how the structure of that subject create like formed, like why is it that structure, and then understanding how it exists and how it exists in it in its environment. So there's sort of like a history that I learn through observing something, and through that, that's what I've been able to do with this project, is sort of not be such a terrestrial person and go down into the ocean and be more of an aquatic creature and observe everything in its, you think about it, it's like it's a weightless place. And it just must be beautiful to be down there. Like if you think about the fish are just swimming around like butterflies, or, it must be just incredible.
Well, and I just want to add that I love kind of that ability to observe and learn from the observation and from the artistic practice, Ellen. I mean, the way you have, say, the Pycnopodia, the sunflower sea star, interacting with the sea urchin, and how its 2 feet are so much a part of the illustration, which is so much a part of how it interacts with its environment. And then that allows you to put it on a rock or eating the urchin, or it's very cool. And I think it's the power of learning science as an artist, which is something that Ellen and I both share. It's very exciting.
I think there's a level of curiosity that comes along with observation. I think once you start observing something, you become curious about why or how that thing that you're looking at is the way it is.
You know, too, it strikes me that one of the things this book does quite superbly well with since these, because I never thought about it before, was we learn by virtue of both of your artistic flair. Josie, it's your beautiful and kind of transparent prose. Ellen, it's your beautiful and I think transparent is also a good way to describe your illustrations. Term that you both have used is the word canopy and understory. And these are terms you usually associate with terrestrial forests. I've heard them before. So talk about finding a terrestrial equivalent under the ocean.
Wow, yeah. Well, it's they are called kelp forests, which bring, and part of our above below whole mission is to bring attention to that the forests on land are afforded to these forests under the ocean. And I think there is the term forest from how we know it on land implies an abundance. And I think we very much want to communicate that these forests underwater are absolutely are abundant. They are responsible for an abundance, and that is technically the canopy form in kelp means that it rises to the surface and creates a canopy. It needs that. It needs to use the power of sunlight. But what that means is that there is space below for all these other creatures and other algae, other marine algae and other kelps to grow at lower levels, just like there are different strata in the forest that we can hike through.
And there's a whole level of inhabitants in a kelp forest, going from the bottom all the way up to the canopy, just like there is in a terrestrial forest.
One of the things that the important things that comes off here, and I'm going to just read from the book, the entanglement of interdependencies is known as the trophic food web. Who eats whom, and bull kelp is the foundation of this web in the coastal waters of the Northeastern Pacific Ocean. This is a really important topic to understand. So could you explain to us what the trophic food web is? And also, you talk about a trophic cascade, which we're kind of in the middle of, not as good as the food web.
Yeah, so trophic refers to food. So a trophic level, trophic food web. I'm kind of using both terms interchangeably there. That is the complex interactions that is who eats who, and the primary producers, the kelp and the seaweeds, are just like the grass that herbivores eat on land. They create all of this algal material that drifts down. It's constantly sloughing off. And is murky in a healthy kelp forest. Divers would call it low visibility. But that snow, that algal snow, drifts down and supports all these herbivores, snails and urchin and abalone. These are all invertebrates that eat that primary production. So they're kind of a first level. And then there are the secondary predators of those herbivores, which are hunters, like the hunter starfish, the Pycnopodia, the sunflower sea star. The sea otter is another renowned predator of the sea urchin and the abalone. So those are kind of top keystone species at the top. And so that there's also fish that some might eat the algae and some might use the kelp as their habitat. So that primary production is kind of the base of the food web. And then there's the other purpose of the kelp, which is as eco-engineer, as habitat creator. So those are both equally important functions of the kelp forest. And it's as primary production. So if we go back to that food web and we go back to that connection of algae to urchin to, say, sea star, that is that if there's a disruption in there, Like when the sea otter were basically killed off on the North Coast and all the way up through its whole range in the 1800s because of the fur trade, what that did was that took out a top predator, a keystone species, out of the system. So that meant there was only one left. And there it's the ripple effect of that is called is the trophic cascade, is when one element of your web is disrupted, and it creates this larger ripple effect throughout the whole food web. So that's the trophic cascade. And we had a second event in 2014, and just around then, when the sea stars, those big Pycnopodia sunflower sea stars, contracted the starfish wasting disease and virtually disappeared overnight. And
Along
that.
with a bunch of other sea stars, species along the coast. I mean, I think that in Santa Cruz, you guys probably also saw the disappearance of the ochre sea stars, along the shore there as well.
Yeah. And some places the ochre stars have come back and some places they haven't, but the sunflower sea star as top predator has not come back out in the wild. It's a deep water starfish. So that has had this profound effect on the entire food web because the urchin came out of their cracks, started eating the kelp. The kelp was stressed because of warmer oceans, and this declined into this regime shift in many places, especially on the North Coast, into these rich biodiverse kelp forests shifting to what's called an urchin barren. And Ellen has this just spectacular image in there that I think communicates so much of it, which is the stalk of the understory kelp with the urchin that has been eating it down. And it's kind of this really great illustration of how these voracious urchins can impact the kelp forest and really create what we would call a wildfire underwater.
I would say that that image, if you just, that's only one stipe. And if you imagined a forest that has been clear cut and just replace it with stipes and sea urchins, that's what's happening down under the water, under the surface in those kelp forests at this point.
You're showing us that picture. And one of the things that I just thought was that, the old adage that pictures worth 1,000 words, it's not. A picture is communicates information in a manner that words cannot, and words do what a picture cannot. And the two of them together, use it effectively in this book. Between the third element, which is the design of the book, really effectively tell a much more dimensional story than either one will by itself. Talk a little bit about, I'd like to hear both of you talk about the design of the book, which is, I think, really a critical part because it makes it a pleasure to read, and it also helps communicate what I think you want to communicate, which is a real, true, impressive vision of what's going on beneath the lid of the ocean.
Oh, can I start with this one? I would just say that I think that's a result of incredible teamwork. I think that Josie and I work together really well. And also Josie brings to this project a whole history of making books, design work, and artwork. She has an incredible eye for color. And then also with all of her research and history, she knows what she's talking about. She knows the history of the kelp. She knows the history of the research that's gone into it. And so her ability to, I think, make those decisions and pick out what's important, what it is that we are trying to do with this book, I think she knew what she wanted to do from the beginning, and she just guided us through it.
It really was a wonderful, wonderful collaboration. But I have made a lot of books. And one of the, usually I'm using my own artwork, but there's a similarity to, because I use the scanner. I made this book in 2014, An Ocean Garden. It's been re-released, and I have the other copy in the back. But it too has lots of open white space. The images are either on black or on white. And I'm very, very, I think all of us, whether it's Ellen or Mariana, who's also part of this team, very committed to that kind of openness that these images that are on an empty ground can afford, because then you can really play with the edges. You can give the text room to breathe. And even way back on some of my first books about beach stones, where I was working with other authors, I was the artist working with other authors. The power of word and image together in a designed book is, I'm just so wonderful to hear you say that, Rick, because that's really the where we feel the power is in that combination. One is supporting the images or supporting the text, and the text is really supporting that imagery, and really hoping there's space in there, physical as well as kind of narrative space, so that you can be curious and go out and explore this world even further, whether it's on the beach or through the website.
You know, one of the things that struck me while you were talking was that the power of narrative for humans is that there's a story, there's a plot, a beginning, a middle, and an end. In this book, you might first think, well, there's no plot, but there really is. And there's a good guy, there's a bad guy. And you create the plot by introducing the characters and then taking us out further into the world of the kelp up and down the coast and come to this kind of, wonderful conclusion. So the good guy is, of course, the bull kelp and its various kelp, other species of kelp. The bad guy is, I think, beyond humans, are identifiably the urchins. So talk about creating these urchins, which are somewhat beautiful, although the spikes are so threatening to someone like me. I wouldn't even want to get near them. And creating the urchin as, a critter that by virtue of how it's defined, it just becomes a bad guy once things get out of balance.
Yeah. Well, you mean creating it as far as an image? It just is, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful creature. It has structure. It has a pattern to it. It has color. It has these incredible, funny little 2 feet, which I don't know if they're 2 feet, but they're little. The little things that come out from its body, which I did not put in those illustrations, but it's a fascinating thing. And it has these little teeth that are like they're underneath it. It's beautiful. But as far as like writing the story so that it becomes, in a sense, it's empathetic. It's not just a bad character. It's just in a bad situation that it's become this way.
Absolutely. And I think it's really important that we stress that the urchins, the purple urchins and the red urchins, which are native to here in this range of the coast, are native here. They are absolute players in the kelp forest. And there are urchins in all the world's kelp forests. There's many species, and so they really, we hope they're not the bad guy per se, but this, as you pointed out, Rick, the situation they've been put in is that they got very, very hungry. One of the scariest things in our ocean right now is when it gets warm. And I can't stress enough how much these kelp need a cold ocean. It's why they are doing better generally in Alaska than they're doing down here in California. A cold ocean holds more nutrients than a warm ocean. If you think of the tropics, generally things are small that grow down there. You don't have these big kelps because these big kelps need intense nutrient load that come in temperate oceans. So cold ocean needs a constant renewal of those nutrients. So here on the open coast, that renewal of nutrients comes with constant wave action and the power of upwelling that happens in the spring, where that cold, nutrient-dense water comes up from below, which comes up in those typical spring seasons. But if we have a warming ocean event like we had in 2016, 2015, 2016, when the blob came down and parked itself off our coast, that blob of warm water, that is the stressor that started the upsurge in urchin activity. It was the combination of the warm ocean event, which was stressing out the kelp to begin with, so there wasn't quite as much of it. There was the die off of the sunflower sea stars, so the urchin were without predators. And then they came out of their cracks and their holes, which you can see they can build. Urchins can live perfectly fine without coming out of their hole if there's enough kelp material drifting down to them. But without the kelp and without the predator, the urchins came out of their cracks and started going out and looking for their lunch. And that meant eating the kelp that was remaining, this stressed kelp. So one of the scary things is that in 2026, 27, we're looking at a possibly warm cycle in the ocean again. We had a pretty cool, nice cold year in 24, 25. And so the kelps in these past years, and especially with some of the restoration efforts that have been going on, kind of had a little bit of a resurgence. But the NOAA, all the things that come into my feed and my inbox is indicating that we are going to have a warm ocean event for the next year or two. And that will put, again, another huge strain on the kelp. And it will be a test to all these restoration efforts that are happening up and down the coast.
One of the things that was so effective was the structure of the book, not just the design, but also, the way you lay out the notions and the characters, then the places that these things are taking place. Talk about creating the structure. Did that just do itself? Was that from the website? Or how much of that, too, I think, was a result of the collaboration between the visual and the written aspects of the story you're trying to tell?
Yeah, that structure was in place from the start of the website. I think one of my experiences when I was writing The Curious World of Seaweed and really getting deep into the science and the ecology and the knock-on effects of what affects one thing affects another in this kelp forest world or in this kelp and seaweed world, the nearshore ocean ecology generally. Was that a lot of articles would come out about a specific aspect, but there was no place to kind of get information about the whole kelp forest, this holistic place. And I also was very conscious of the fact that for you in Santa Cruz, or for me if I'm up in Mendocino or Fort Bragg, or if I'm taking a trip up to Puget Sound, or my friends in British Columbia. Everybody was looking at a different scenario play out with their kelp forest, their bull kelp forest, but it was with this same suite of characters. They just had different, like, are they there? Are they not there? And so that I found, I was like, this was, even before the pandemic when everybody gets on Zoom calls and can, I was like, wow, people need to hear the story. People from California need to hear what's going on in Southeast Alaska. With those same characters, like the sea otter. How would we know in California that in Southeast Alaska there's plenty of sea otter? It's like sea otter heaven up there. And so their bull kelp is actually doing quite well. But then once Ellen came in, I mean, just having, being able to work with her on these character icons was just, it just all clicked together.
Ellen, one thing I wanted to ask you and Josie both, you're both pretty well deep into the science, yet you're communicating to a lay audience. Talk about creating images that partake of science, but also speak directly to a lay audience. And Josie, the same with thing with the prose. It's beautiful. It's fun to read. It's really well written. Doesn't draw attention to itself and say, "Hey, I'm great literature." It says what needs to be said, really beautifully, though. So talk about, the intersection of art and science and using art to convey science more concisely and more enjoyably for those who partake of the book.
That's a big question. That's very interesting. I've done a lot of work for natural history museums, and doing museum exhibits, dioramas, other types of exhibits in the developmental stage of those exhibits is when you decide what time of year these exhibits are taking place, like the dioramas. Specifically, what time of day. And then everything that lives in that environment gets condensed into that specific moment that you're representing. And along with that is there's always a story. So you're always trying to convey a story through the visual aspect of either a diorama or whatever other aspect you're putting into the museum exhibit. And so that story becomes important. It's the educational aspect, right? But you want to make it fun. You want to make it approachable for all ages, all levels of interest. So you want to have things that are, I don't even know what the word is, just enticing, I guess. For lots of different people, so that you can try and educate and teach.
And I think there's Ellen's kind of translation of close observation and that scientific training of working in that background, but then being freed up a little bit in this scenario where we don't have the backgrounds and she and this playing with layers. It's been just so wonderful to watch how she works. I mean, you should explain it in a moment, but let's the word and image come together. In terms of the writing for me, I'm not trained as a scientist, so I'm very conscious of the fact that there is a vocabulary that I am learning. And I am writing for someone like myself who might want to learn that vocabulary. So you might put the word trophic and food together so that you can realize, like a scientist might not write that way because they have this assumption of this base knowledge. And because I don't have that, I didn't even take botany in college. But I like to write, and I like as a it's been an interesting transition for me as a visual artist, writing and taking myself out of the story, and yet writing for someone like me or like you, Rick, who's walking the beach, and really, how do we engage with this world that we can't see? And so that's kind of always top of mind, and I think one of the other things from the very start of all of this work, and I was thinking about this a lot when I wrote The Curious World of Seaweed, the second book on seaweed, was how do we make it algal-centric? How do we make sure the writing and the imagery, and Ellen does this so well because she's looking very carefully and it's interpreted by her, but it's pretty true to real life. It's this really nice combination of realistic and yet having flair, and the writing the same way. How do we make sure these organisms are what are absolutely foremost? This book is not about us humans. We have to shift our attention away from ourselves and into this mysterious world that's under the water. I often have to catch myself and not write our ocean. It's very, very easy to say, oh, in our oceans, it is like this. Well, no, this ocean is not ours. It is the ocean. And that's just something that I think I've grown in my writing as I write more and more to keep that lyrical sense and have fun with it.
Talk about some of the other creatures that, are the characters in this book. Of course, We all love the sea otters. They're just beautiful and wonderful, but you bring in the birds and the fish. How do you, or do you like have favorites and say, oh, I love these birds, this critter, or that guy so much, I want to write a bunch about him. But then, you have to say, well, no, I'm telling this story. So talk about the interplay of the different elements and how you feature them in writing and in illustration.
Ooh, well, I'll talk about the cormorants because and the cormorants are just so cool. I think as we were developing the website and the book, we realized that we wanted to not only expand the story of the kelp forest and be clear about how wide-ranging its impact is, but also bring in audiences that have a profound interest in birds. And might not have considered how important the kelp forest is to these seabirds. So the cormorant, for one, and I got to go up and observe them in Sonoma County on this cliff, and watching cormorants nest on a sliver of a slice, a ledge that's no bigger than 6 inches, and have three chicks that grow very large very quickly. Living in their nest that is a bunch of seaweed glued together by guano on that ledge, and realizing that those chicks are growing so quickly because right off that coast is a kelp forest full of fish. And those fish are absolutely foundational for the health of these seabirds. So, and in fact, connecting with groups that do tons of seabird surveys, and they do nesting surveys and see how many chicks survive, is a direct connection to the health of the oceans, so that we can learn a lot from things that we can observe easily, which is eggs and chicks and survivability of seabirds and shorebirds, can tell us a lot about what's happening. And then thinking about, well, the fish in the kelp forest, and I think of Ellen's little schools of fish that, and all of her fish that are kind of there in the background of so many of her illustrations. But Ellen, you're talk about making the cormorant. I mean, the cormorant's just so beautiful.
Oh well, the cormorant's so much fun, and the diving, they're just so beautiful. How much they swim in the water. But I was as you were talking, I was thinking about the plovers and how there's that same connection with the kelp, only it's very different. So on on the beaches we have the kelp that washes ashore and it dries up, and as it's deteriorating, there's the small little sand bugs that are eating the kelp, and then the plovers are there eating the bugs, and that's where they end up nesting. That's where their babies grow up, the chicks grow up, and so in the same way that you're talking about the cormorants, the plovers are having the same relationship with the kelp. If the kelp's not there, then they're not going to have the feeding ground, right? Like the fish, for their young. So there's I think it's interesting because that sort of pulls it up into two different places and two different stories that are exactly the same.
As I read this book, one of the things that I thought was that, you guys do a wonderful job of balancing the vision of the ocean. On one hand, I mean, the situation is pretty dire. We have warmed the oceans. I mean, now they're talking about essentially strip mining the bottom of the ocean, which is going to destroy so much of stuff we don't even know about. It's like, strip mining the Grand Canyon from the air or something. Now, probably not the best idea. But you also convey the beauty and the power of the creatures that are there, so that when we read this book, you exit reading this book thinking, well, as long as we don't do something really stupid, this is all can at least work out. Talk about balancing that positive vision so that, the book doesn't feel like it was written by Debbie Downer, but also that, the positive self feels true, feels right. And that's what you want to essentially, you're trying to grow in the reader, like the power that you see in the ocean to recover of the kelp and some of the other creatures that, the sea otters, the sea stars, they're even nursing sea stars back to life, which is astonishing to me.
Yeah, there is incredible restoration work going on. I think one of the motivations for this book in the first place was in driving up the coast to Mendocino and Fort Bragg and stopping at Van Dam State Park, where there's just been historic kelp beds for hundreds, thousands of years, and watching those slowly go away and stopping, say, in 2019 and seeing this, beautiful cove with sandy beach and people out kayaking, etc. Absolutely beautiful. But you wouldn't, if you didn't know what was missing, you would assume this was the normal. This was fine. And I think that notion that we might think that these coastlines without kelp is the baseline, is the starting point, is normal, is really this whole idea of the shifting baseline, is a new normal. How do we remind ourselves what the normal is? And how do we remind ourselves what we're forgetting? And I think that's really part of it is as we encounter all this other information about warming oceans, how do we have a picture in our mind of what should be there, what not to forget? And so that's really what this book is trying to do is paint that picture of that richness. And so that can motivate all, there is lots of effort going into kelp restoration right now. There are lots of groups collecting urchins as divers and as volunteers in various coves. There's all sorts of research in kelp cultivation and kind of assisting the kelp by planting, outplanting baby kelps to assist in the reproductive material from year to year to augment it, what is naturally there. And to understand that work that the scientists are doing, we need a deeper general knowledge and reverence for the kelp forest. So I think that's really what Ellen and I, if we can build curiosity and reverence for this world down there, then we'll feel like, okay, now go out and connect with the information that's coming at us every day, in terms of changing oceans.
I think that what you did with the book in dividing up the regional stories, giving a history of each one of those places, I think that having so we have a story, we have characters, but then what Josie's done is she's put those that story in different places. And so we could see how that story plays out given different environments. Like if you have colder water, different things like that, what happens? What happens with the characters? We have more sea otters up top, up north. So the impact of the loss of the Pycnopodia, the large sunflower sea star, doesn't have such impact, whereas down further south, it does have an impact. So I think that the history, seeing and understanding what that history is and how each of the characters play in and out of that history is really important. I feel like the illustrations were kind of the easy part. Like I didn't have to do the downer part. I was able to really just enjoy each and every part of this, the characters, the stories, all of it. I could really just relish in their beauty.
And your delight comes through in them. And I think, eliciting that delight will hopefully, just make people more curious and more observant themselves and pay attention to the news and, maybe walk on the beach instead of drive their car somewhere.
Yeah.
Well, it strikes me too that Again, getting back to story, that what you've done here, the typical narrative has characters. We meet them, they do go through events, and it changes their lives. And at the end, they look through the kitchen window, they have an epiphany, and all is good. What you've done here is a really fascinating spin on narrative structure itself. You give us the story, the characters. Then you kind of talk about the interplay, and the story, I think, really takes place in that journey up the coast, where we see that the changes we've made in the environment that are showing up down in the South have had a lot of consequences that are the lives of our characters, as it were, have changed, whereas they've changed differently as you travel up, so that the plot unfolds as you, as narrator, travel up and down. So I just think that that's a really interesting way to create a narrative out of nonfiction, and that satisfies our need for story, but also takes us deeper into an understanding of the science and our world in a way that's, enjoyable for us. So we kind of get it and love it.
Well, thanks, Rick. That's so great. And what I want to just encourage listeners is that the website is structured the same way, but each of those regions has quite a bit more information on it, and as do the character pages. So you really can go a little bit deeper. And then each of those regions has a page of resources that's dedicated to that area. So you can go to that region and link out to tribe. There's incredible work done by tribes in each of these regions, and there's some really great story maps. There's really good information about kelp restoration that's happening in that area. There's a whole resources page. There's also a whole restoration section of the website that goes into how this kelp restoration work is being done. And we have, I think, five case studies of kelp restoration projects that also track those different regions. So dig a little deeper. It's out there, and there's so much more to learn. We're just thrilled to have a book version of the story.
I think there's a lot of you've mentioned this before, Josie, that the we know so much about the forests on land. We know so much more about how the interactions between the different species work. We know about the different species themselves. And these forests that are under the surface of the water, we don't have so much information. It is very mysterious, and we're just learning. We're just learning.
We're all just learning, and it's fun. And your ability to combine art and science and the art of narrative, both visually in the illustrations and in the language, Josie, it's just a wonderful combination. And it's happily, it's a quick and fun read. The new book by Josie Iselin and Ellen Littweiler is The Mysterious World of the Bull Kelp Forest. Thank you for joining me, ladies.
Thank you for having us here.
Absolutely. It's been really fun.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.